The Words of Jesus by Robert C. Newman, a survey of Jesus, various forms of speech. The words of Jesus as recorded in the Gospels give us considerable amount of variety. Jesus sometimes speaks in rather short sound bites, and at other times in rather long discourses. We see Jesus' speech recorded also in dialogues and in parables. Jesus' words often have a poetic or rhetorical character, using parallelisms, a feature of Hebrew poetry, but also a feature of rhetoric. We see that in the book of Deuteronomy, and actually see that in a fair amount of even public speech today. And a use of wordplay. Short sound bites, some samples of Jesus' speech, words that take the form of short sound bites. The proverb he uses, "Physician, heal yourself." The idea here, which he's saying that his people in Nazareth might quote to him when he comes back to visit them, is basically that they have heard stories of his doing healing and such elsewhere, and they would like to see some samples here. So it's the typical proverb that basically applies a rather concrete sort of statement to a more general situation. So the literal meaning of the proverb is, you're a doctor, heal yourself. The application here is, you're a miracle worker, and you've been doing that all over the place. We want to see you do some here in your hometown. A metaphor. You are the salt of the earth. Jesus uses this metaphor for his followers. We'd apply that to the Christian church today, that somehow we are to function in the world the way salt does in perhaps food. We would have to explain that to work that out. Jesus sometimes uses paradoxes. The first shall be last, and the last first would be an example of that. And sometimes he uses hyperbole. This is sometimes tough for us to get a handle on, particularly when we're thinking of Scripture in terms of inerrancy and in terms of speaking as though it's propositional or something of that sort. Well, hyperbole is a exaggeration intended for effect, and it's rather like what a cartoonist does when he does a caricature. He draws a person in a certain way to emphasize certain features of the person so that you can recognize him or something of that sort. So Richard Nixon used to be drawn with a 5 o'clock shadow all the time, or Bill Clinton with a big square jaw, etc. Those are samples of that sort of thing. While I sample hyperbole, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to go to heaven, an example of hyperbole. Long discourses. Matthew has a number of these. The Sermon on the Mount, taking up full 3 chapters, Matthew, sending the 12, most chapter 10, Parables of the Kingdom, all chapter 13, Living as Disciples, chapter 18, The Woe to the Scribes and the Pharisees in chapter 23, and the Olivet Discourse in chapters 24 and 25. Luke has mostly more medium-length discourses, typically shorter than Matthew's. The Sermon on the Plain in chapter 6, only about a third the length of the Sermon on the Mount. There's been some argument over the years, centuries, I suppose, even, on whether the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain are two different reports of the same event, or two different occasions in which Jesus gave a rather similar presentation. Sending the 72 in Luke chapter 10, the coming of the kingdom in chapter 17, the signs of the end in chapter 21. In John, Mark doesn't have really much in the way of long discourses, by the way, except the Olivet Discourse, the Jesus Discourse on the New Birth in chapter 3. Jesus remarks on his work and credentials in chapter 5, and on the bread of life in chapter 6, the Good Shepherd in chapter 10, the Upper Room Discourse, 14, 15, 16, 17, much the longest in the Gospel of John. Quick sketch of the Sermon on the Mount begins with a Beatitudes, a series of blessings pronounced on a certain type of person, and as you look at it, you see it's a somewhat surprising sort of person from the perspective of what we might think it was worldly wisdom, but it's the biblical picture of the kind of person who will really be blessed. Compare that with the blessings and woes of Luke chapter 6. We can see some strong overlap, and it's one of the things that leaves us uncertainty on whether we're looking at two different reports of the same event or two different occasions in which Jesus gave similar statements. The question of you're the salt of the world, which we mentioned here a bit ago, we might ask the question, how is salt used? And some of the ways it was used in antiquity are the same as it is used today. For instance, it add taste to food, which might otherwise be felt to be rather tasteless. But it was also used as a preservative back then, whereas now that's much rarer because we have other ways of preserving food, having had our technology advance a good deal. So if you kind of thought which how does salt function, and then start trying to apply that to how the Christians should function in the world, one, adding taste to food, etc., the society we live in should be a more pleasant place, if you like, than it would be if we're not here. And the Christians need to examine their own activities and motivations and such to see how that might be. And salt is a preservative we may act as a function of preserving our society from disaster and judgment and such, and I think that's a fair comparison as well. Some have pointed out that salt, when it goes into wounds, stings, and the Christian presence in a society can have an aggravating effect on people who want to go on in their sin and such, and yet that's something I think we're supposed to be doing. And salt is something that causes people to thirst, and our lifestyle should be such as to have people want to know Jesus, if you like. We're also called the light of the world. We ask yourself, how does light function? And it seems to me as Jesus uses it in the passage there in the Beatitudes, right after the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount, that he looks at two things. A light is viewed from a long distance. Light, dark, night, that sort of thing, makes clear the presence of something that might otherwise not be seen at all. So a city set on a hill cannot be hidden in the context, I think, of thinking the fact that you can see a city at night from a long distance away because of the lights of it. And the other thing then looks at light close up, and close up light actually illuminates its surroundings. So it suggests two things, that ways in which Christians function, that the effect of Christianity should be able to be seen at a long distance, perhaps by changing society, something of that sort. And close up, it illuminates things around and shows up sins and things of that sort, I think would be perhaps what's going on, helps people see what life is really about, perhaps. The rest of chapter 5 on the Sermon on the Mount is about real righteousness. And Jesus points out that real righteousness doesn't change. Real righteousness characterizes kingdom people. He contrasts murder versus hate and suggests that hate is actually a motivation that leads to murder, etc. And one doesn't solve the murder problem until one has solved the hate problem. And so we need to realize that sin is about attitudes and not just about actions. He does that a second example with adultery versus lust, and oaths versus truth-telling, and retaliation versus non-resistance, and loving our friends versus loving our enemies. In chapter 6, Jesus talks about wealth and anxiety, contrasting the earthly wealth with the heavenly wealth. The need to realize that we have to serve the right master. We can't serve both God and money. That we need to think about our priorities, and if we think about our priorities properly, it will reduce our anxiety. Chapter 7 begins with Jesus' statements on judgment. Ask, where does right judgment start? And right judgment starts with ourselves. What's the meaning of it? Will be measured to you. There's perhaps a play on that. Part of it perhaps is use the divine passive with the judgment that we mete out to others. God will judge us one day, it will be measured to you, and also perhaps just a more generic passive, even in this life, the judgment we mete out to others will tend to come back to us. If we're judgmental, people will tend to react to us that way. If we are people who are compassionate and try to be loving to others and such, that we will tend to get better return in some ways as well. Rest chapter 7 is basically about obedience and ends up with the parable of the wise and foolish builders. A person who hears Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount but doesn't act upon them is like a foolish builder, like a person who builds a house with no foundation, whereas a person who hears Jesus' words and acts upon them is like a wise builder who builds with a solid foundation. We have examples of Jesus in dialogue, another form of Jesus' words, sometimes with his disciples. A sample of that would be the one where Jesus asks his disciples, who do people say that I am? And they give various answers. And who do you say that I am? Peter comes forward with his famous answer, etc. So we can see dialogue with disciples intended to get them to think about things, to draw them out, if you like. Dialogue with seekers has a somewhat similar purpose as well. A good sample would be the rich young ruler, where the rich young ruler really thought himself to be in pretty good shape until Jesus puts his finger on the fact that the rich young ruler was depending far too much on his wealth for security and couldn't let go of his wealth. And Jesus basically warns his disciples of what the dangers of that are. Jesus also uses dialogue with his opponents. A good sample of that would be the paying taxes to Caesar, where the Pharisees and the Herodians believe they've got Jesus caught in a bind from which there'd be no way to escape. If he says to pay taxes to Caesar, the Pharisees will spread that around the people and he will lose his popular following, if you like. And if Jesus says not to pay taxes to Caesar, then the Herodians will see that that gets back to Pilate and the governor, and Jesus will be in considerable danger of being put to death. And Jesus' response to that is a marvelous example of his wisdom, the wisdom of God, etc., and an illustration of the scripture that there is no wisdom or that will work against the Lord. Paying taxes to Caesar. Jesus' parables, most of Jesus' parables fall in the category of an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Jesus' parables are some of the earliest parables that have survived. We have a couple of rabbinic parables from a rabbi in the generation just preceding it, Hillel, but otherwise all of our rabbinic parables that are associated with a particular speaker come from after Jesus' time. There are, in fact, about 1,500 rabbinic parables that have survived. Only 324 of these predate 200 A.D., and only three of these predate Jesus' ministry. We have, in Jesus' ministry, about 60 to 75 parables of Jesus, depending on how short something can be, and still count as a parable. Why did Jesus use parables? Well, we get some hints of that in various places, the most explicit in Matthew 13. In Matthew 13, we basically see that Jesus used parables to mystify his opponents while enlightening his followers. How is that? Well, the things that Jesus said without an interpretation would be somewhat mystifying, and his opponents were too proud to ask him what he meant. His disciples were not, and so his disciples found out what he meant, and his opponents did not. But Jesus used parables for other purposes as well. He's using parables before Matthew 13. He uses parables that aren't mystifying. So another purpose of Jesus' parables is to teach the truth vividly and memorably. We can see that with perhaps the Luke 15, the parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin and the lost son, where it's fairly obvious what's going on in these particular parables. A third use which Jesus makes of the parables is also found in the Old Testament. In the parable that the prophet Nathan gives David, when David has committed sin with Bathsheba, and Nathan wants to bring David to admit it and to repent, huh? So Nathan's ewe lamb parable in 2 Samuel 12 would be a sample of this. Jesus does something similar in his two debtor parable in Luke 7, where he gives to this Pharisee a parable about two debtors owing a moneylender a significant amount of money, but one of them owes 10 times as much as the other. Neither could pay. The moneylender graciously forgives them, but both, who would be the most, who would love the moneylender most? And the answer which the Pharisee gives, well, presumably it's the guy who's been forgiven the most. And Jesus then turns that around on him and shows that that's the explanation for this woman who has been putting pouring perfume over Jesus' feet and such, that that shows that she has been forgiven more than the Pharisee has. Jesus' parables can be categorized by type. The ones we're most familiar with are what we might call story parables. A brief story is given with characters and action and a plot. The parable of a lost son, a prodigal son, would be one of these. Similitudes, on the other hand, are very short and have no real plot. And a sample of that would be the woman putting the three measures of putting the leaven in three measures of a flour, and then the whole thing becomes leaven, where you really have no real plot. Sample parables are another category. They're like story parables. But instead of being an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, these make their points by giving a sample of the behavior that Jesus wants us to imitate or avoid, rather than by making an analogy. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector is one of these. Huh? The parable is about forgiveness, and that's its lesson, is about forgiveness. The parable is about pride and humility, and that's what shows up in the application as well, etc. It's a sample, if you like. Acted parables are another category. We see these in the Old Testament as well. Old Testament prophets did these. This is where a story, if you like, is acted out rather than spoken. In the New Testament, Jesus cursing the fig tree is, I believe, an acted parable, that the fig tree's leaves without fruit, which it's a type of a tree that puts on fruit ahead of its leaves, suggest that what we're looking at here is a profession of righteousness without the real fruit, if you like. And I think it's fair to say, given its context, that the fruitless fig tree, if you like, is a picture of the state of Israel at the time that Jesus comes. Are not willing to accept him, though they make professions to be righteous, and the cursing is the disaster that's going to come upon the nation as a result. I give you here a list of Jesus' parables by topic. I'll actually just give you a list of the topics. My suggestion here that Jesus has something like 5 Christological parables, 3 parables of lost and found, 4 of forgiveness and mercy, 3 on prayer, 2 on transformation, 7 on stewardship, 4 on invitation and rejection, 6 on the second coming, 16 on warning and judgment, 7 on parables of the kingdom, 6 sample parables, and about 10 acted parables. Parable of sower would be a nice sample of a story parable that's an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. We have this guy who's going through his field, or he's a laborer working somewhere else's field. Anyway, he's sowing seed on the field. It's wheat seed, and he's using the broadcast method, which isn't that you dig little holes and put seed in, but that the ground is prepared for the seed, and then you walk through and scatter seed. And the question here is, we would ask ourselves, what does the seed represent? What do the different kinds of soils mean? He throws it on the soils, and some of it is a soil that's the walkway through the fields, etc. And the seed doesn't do anything on that, and others fall on thin soil over bedrock and grows up, but doesn't last on that. And other falls in good soil, but it's got corn seed in it, thorn plants in it, and they choke out the wheat and the other falls of the soil. What do the different kinds of soil mean would be a second question to ask. And then what does it mean for the grain, for the seeds to produce grain and the different amounts? What does the seed represent? What do the different kinds of soil mean? What's the significance of producing grain in the different amounts? And here in this particular parable, Jesus gives us an interpretation. And so we can actually answer those sorts of things. The seed represents the message of the kingdom, what we might call today the gospel, if you like. The soils represent different kinds of reception, different kinds of people, if you like, different ways in which this message will be received. And the making grain, people can get arguments on whether anybody but the last sample of the good soil, any of the others are actually saved or not, and we won't answer that for you here. I don't think that's the main purpose of the parable. The main purpose of the parable, I think, is to show that this message of the kingdom, this gospel, this good news, is going to receive very different receptions in spite of the fact that it's good news. And that itself would be a surprise, I think, to the disciples initially, and yet that's been what it has turned out to be over history. Further on in that same set of parables in Matthew 13, we have the two parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price. Both are very similar. They're about finding and giving up everything to possess. So one fellow in a field comes across a hidden treasure, and when he finds it, he hides it again and goes and buys the field. And he has to give up everything he owns to get that field. He's glad to do it when he gets it. The other is about a pearl merchant out looking for pearls, and when he finds a pearl, a really valuable pearl, he is willing to give up everything to have and own that pearl, if you like. Both very similar about finding and giving everything to possess. A question we'd ask is, who is the finder? And two rather different answers have been given to that. One suggested that the finder is a lost person who finds the gospel, and the other answer has been given is that the finder is Christ, who is seeking his people, etc. I discussed this in my PowerPoint talk in Parables of the Kingdom, and you can go look there and see what my solution to that is, why I think so, but I believe that the finder is actually one who is stumbles across or is looking for the kingdom, if you like. What's the treasure of the pearl? My view of the matter would be it's the gospel or it's Christ, if you like. The other alternative, where the finder is Christ, would be that it is God's people. Some would suggest that the hidden treasure in the field is Israel and the pearl of great price is the church or something of that sort. But I don't think that's the way to go, and I suggest in that PowerPoint talk why that's so. What does spending all mean? I think it means that person who wants Christ may have to give up everything to have him. And it's not that we can somehow pay for Christ, that we can earn Christ, we can earn our salvation, but that having Christ may cost us everything, and that is certainly a biblical teaching. It was a great bargain. That, I think, is the point of both of the parables, is that although the person gives up everything to have this treasure, this pearl, that person has gotten a great bargain. Who has the joy? The suggestion is the finder, the one who finds Jesus. The parable of Pharisee and the tax collector is a sample parable, not an earthly story with heavenly meaning. Background on Pharisees is helpful. The problem today is that Pharisee has become a word for hypocrite in the English language as a result of the Gospels today. But at the time the Gospels were written, although there were certainly people who were aware there were hypocritical Pharisees, Pharisees were looked at as people who were really serious about religion in Jewish society. And the Pharisee's prayer is a prayer of thanking God to start with, but as you read it more carefully, you see he's thanking God for who he, the Pharisee, is. Tax collectors have never been popular people, probably in any society, except with people who receive the taxes that the tax collectors collect, they were especially despised in Palestine at Jesus' time because Palestine was under Roman control, and the taxes went to Rome or went to a non-elected government, Herod and such, and was not always so well used anyway. So tax collectors were typically viewed as traitors of some sort, and scum in any case. And yet the tax collector's prayer here is prayer recognizing his sin and calling upon God for forgiveness. Jesus says, Jesus' verdict is that it's the tax collector who goes down from the temple justified, not the Pharisee, in spite of the fact that Pharisee's prayer is a prayer of self-justification. Because what Jesus means by justified isn't whether we're self-justified, but whether we're God-justified. Well, that's the end of a rather quick talk here, but suggest that studying Jesus' words is a lifelong occupation for the follower of Jesus. And my experience has been that the more I've studied Jesus' words, the more astonished I have been by him and by them. And I think you will find that to be the case as well. May it be so.